It's Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. Guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
Welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast broadcasted from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, New Zealand. My name is Lewis, and I am the host of the show. We're currently in level 4 lockdown, which here is our highest level of COVID-19 alert. But I was recording this intro, and I mentioned that alert level changes were being announced at 4 o'clock, and then I looked at the clock and it was 4:01, so I went and watched them, and I can report we're now at level 3, but I can also report that if you are perhaps an expat or someone listening from overseas interested in New Zealand, New Zealand society and New Zealand culture, that one of the first announcements was that someone was caught going out of Auckland, because you see at the moment Auckland's at level 4 and the rest of New Zealand's at a lower alert level. I was going to say someone was caught going out of Auckland, but what they had on them when they were caught, I would assume would mean they were going into Auckland, because you can't get takeaways at the moment, which seems to be the most hard-hitting problem and issue for most people being in a lockdown. Not a big takeaway man myself, but anyway, bit of food virtue signaling there. They were caught with $100,000 in cash and a boot full of KFC, unquote. Oh no. I thought that wasn't a reaction to that story. I thought my memory card had failed. My memory's failing. Everything's failing. Look, I talked to Pete Get Flushed, and I meet Pete Get Flushed. I met Pete Get Flushed online, as is our modern want, as part of a New Zealand podcast page, which, to be honest, isn't up to much, the page. But Pete is very keen, and shows in what he has accomplished in not so much time with his podcast Get Flushed, which, to be honest, before I made contact with Peter, he made contact with me, or we made contact with each other, I had come across when I was uploading new shows to my New Zealand podcast directory, which is on my website, verbalhighs.com, and I was kind of picking out the more quirky ones, and I thought Seen and Heard, spelt H-E-R-D, the New Zealand Beef and Lamb podcast, was a good one. But then I spotted Pete's Get Flush show, the world's only portable sanitation podcast, which I know recently he's broadened to sanitation in general. It's a bloody poos and wheeze podcast, and it's about people who are in the industry of poos and wheeze. And when you think about it, we all do it. And so in a broad sense, it's a universal topic, but in a specific sense, in terms of why the majority of podcasts that are successful, it's about going an inch wide and mile deep, which isn't a long drop reference. It's a reference to the specificity of Pete's original concept, which is to create a podcast for said industry. And what happened, as we discussed in the podcast, is that he was only a few episodes in, perhaps even one or two, and a company called Sanitrax International, who are a Dutch company who have a whole lot of scratch, which is a slang term for money, and are very big players in the sanitation industry, approached him and said, "Hey, look, can we throw some money your way to keep this going?" And I'll let Pete tell the rest of the story, but it's kind of grown from there. But as I say, it's one part his tenacity and his passion for podcasting, and the fact that he's a grafter, but also that he's found this group of people around the world who now have a kind of a media hub, and with Pete as the spokesperson. Sorry, mate. I really resisted Pete all the potential for poos and wheeze during the episode. Well, actually, I didn't, because we discussed obviously, you know, a bit about Pete, his background, where he's living at the moment. He's broadcasting from a caravan because they're lucky enough to be travelling around New Zealand for a tiki tour, as we say in New Zealand, before before COVID hit. But then, yes, we did get to the bottom of it. we talked about portable toilet history. I mentioned that the first one I remember was at Brown Trout in 1983. I said I was about 4 or 5. I've since realised I was about 6 or 7. That was in Woodville. No, actually, I remember a long drop there and saying to him that I remembered Portaloos kind of coming along after that. We talked about portable toilet technology, portable toilet budgets, portable toilet global supply chain, how COVID's affected that, the portable toilet business size, not that kind of business size, although Pete does talk about some sizable business he discovered in a urinal tray in Hagley Park. We talk about portable toilet innovation, portable toilet design, portable toilet logistics, portable toilet at festivals, portable toilets during pandemics. Great story about how hand sanitizer became contraband. Is that the right word? Contraband became black market fodder. We talked about portable toilet slurping ones. Terrible term for those. We talked about portable toilet photography and Pete's idea for a calendar. Wink. We talked about portable toilets and 9/11. Someone had to put them down there. It's a great story, and he talked to someone who did that. We talked about World Toilet Day, which I don't have on hand, but you can make a note during the episode. And we talked about discharge viscosity in terms of when you empty your truck. Not that kind of discharge viscosity. And then I went online and did a bit of portable toilet internet surfing, and the Prestige Lose quote form, the online quote form, you think about different industries. They have a section of checkboxes for snack fingers and food, full meal, light drinking, coffee, tea, etc., open bar. And when you look at that and think, you probably need about 15 seconds to think about it, that's a poos and wheeze indicator, isn't it? I read it again. Snacks, finger food, full meal, light drinking, coffee, tea, etc., open bar. Ooh. Right, to my sponsors, thank you, Free FM. They dig deep into musical genres. Taking a quick look to the next few days, I see the Retrospect 60s Garage Punk Show, which explores obscure 60s punk from around the world, the Outer Limit Frequency, which similarly explores the far corner of soft rock music. I think they call that yacht. A guy called General Jeff with House Funk and Electro. It's all there. Check out freefm.org.nz. They are Access Radio based in the mighty Waikato, but of course they also broadcast worldwide on Te Interwebs. My little bit of promo, this is a passion project, so you pay by likes, hearts, and online affirmations. If you could share the show, I'd love it. Leave a message anytime, verbalwise, at gmail. Does anyone say .com now? What happened to kim.com? You can share or link with me, Verbal Highs on Twitter, Verbal Highs Podcast on Facebook, Verbal Highs on Apple and Google Podcasts. You can also stream via Spotify or iHeartRadio. I just give it away to all the big tech companies, the billionaires. Take it. Take my coconuts. And it all beams out from my own little pile of ones and zeros, which is verbalhighs.com, which is where you can find that New Zealand podcast directory. What a load of waffle. Thank you, Pete.
This is Dr. Tannen's Verbal Highs.
I'm in the car because we've just...
I've broken up with my wife.
Yeah, well, we've just moved to Motau, which is on the Taranaki coast.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot here. I'm just going to make sure that I'm coming through the right audio. For the first time in 10 years, Lewis, I've had to buy a jar of honey. Because we're on the road,
yeah.
I've got beehives, but I'm not anywhere near them. So, shock horror, I've had to shell out and buy a jar of honey. I think it was like $12 for 400 grams or something.
Honey's like, I don't know, something's happened in my lifetime where honey used to be a consumer good priced comparably to other consumer goods in the supermarket. And
not
now,
anymore.
No. So you've got beehives.
Yeah, at one point I had 42 hives, and it became a pretty much a full-time role, and I made some good money, actually, because I'd sold a bit of honey, and I'm not allowed to say that because I'm not MPI registered. I sold some beehives. I made more money out of actually selling beehives than I did out of selling honey.
I thought most of your working background was the sanitation industry, or was the honey thing more a hobbyist thing?
No, honestly, if I told you the full story, you wouldn't believe me. I've had more jobs than probably half of New Zealand put together. My wife's of the opinion I'm unemployable, Lewis.
Why is that?
I, If I tell you that we've spent the last year in a caravan touring New Zealand, having sold everything, and this is the second time we've done a big tour, you'll get the impression that I've just got really itchy feet and I struggle to sit still and do the same thing week in, week out.
Right, so I can sort of got that feeling, like, looking at you immersing yourself in the podcast project, that, like, you kind of, would it be fair to say that you hone in on something and then it becomes, like, ride or die?
Obsession.
Yeah.
Without a shadow. I'm not going to apologise for that. The reason if I pass out, it's because I'm sitting in the back of the Land Cruiser and it's a really warm day today. I'm on the Taranaki coast.
Yeah.
So if I suddenly fall off the screen, it's because it's that hot in the van that I passed out.
Well, we'll go as long as this will either be like, we'll see how you go in the heat. It'll either be a Rogan length. It'll either be Rogan length and we'll go for 4 hours, or I'll get 20 minutes out of you.
Probably. But I'm sitting in the van because my wife and daughter are in the caravan and they're absolutely over the podcast.
Right.
It's become my primary focus over the last year. And, it started just as a couple of beers one Friday night, saw the Roadcaster, my Roadcast entry form on Facebook and thought, I'll have a go at that.
Yeah.
And it just snowballed into this just beast of a thing now that's Get Flushed. And one of the things we might talk about later is I'm so far into it now that I don't know that I can stop.
Yeah, I
never recover the ground I've made so far.
I just listened to that piece that you did for some kind of podcast network or group on Facebook where you talked about
Podcast Collective,
your process, and that's where I just got that because I got the impression when I first chatted to you, but I was like, wow, this guy is, a real grafter, but it's been quite. It was quite amazing listening to all the offshoots that have sprung from it, which we'll talk about later in the show.
Yeah, but, maybe. It's funny, Pat Spellman from the Touch Project is good friends with my middle boy.
Yeah.
And I sent Pat a note saying, hey, I'm really enjoying your content. He does a really good podcast, the Touch Project. It's about touch rugby. And Pat said to my boy, your dad's just on a different level. He's completely immersed in it. He obviously loves what he's doing.
It's like this guy, I felt like this guy's going to end up with like a Rupert Murdoch-esque media empire from a toilet podcast.
Do you know, it's bizarre. I should at the minute be in Vail in Colorado. I had an invitation from a big software company in the States who service the restroom industry to go over. They're hosting a very exclusive 4-day hooey for some key players, and they asked me to go over. And I'd have loved to have gone, but I can't get back into New Zealand. You can't book an MIQ space. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to give you the opportunity to describe to people what your show is. Like, what is Get Flushed?
So it's, as far as I'm aware, it's the only podcast that's dedicated to the portable sanitation industry. So my background, for the last 4 or 5 years, I worked for a sanitation provider. I haven't got a background in sanitation. I sort of fell into that role through friends of friends of friends, really. But I started the podcast during lockdown last year, lockdown one, and thought, I'd left that role. I'd spent the summer at home. Lockdown happened. And I just thought, I know too much about sanitation to walk away. Couldn't get a job because lockdown was on and nobody was recruiting. Most companies were finding it really tough during that period. And I started the podcast one Friday night, and it's just developed. I've been very fortunate that I managed to land in that tiny niche that I think you said to me in the first time we spoke that you can go an inch wide but a mile.
And I heard you say that in the Facebook thing, and I was like, great,
and I've pushed hard, and I spend a lot of time online using this alias of Pete Get Flushed, a lot of time online in industry groups and Facebook channels and forums, and I just tag everybody who's in the industry. But it started to pay off, and the show's now gone from strength to strength. It's been a good earner because it's attracted sponsorship, and I've been paid to produce episodes, and it's taken over, if I'm honest, Lewis. I never imagined it would
be. No, it's an extraordinary story, and like I say, it's one part, more than in one part, due to your grafting and your tenacity, but also, I was going to talk about that later on, but we'll briefly touch on it, the fact that you kind of proved the inch wide, mile deep thing that I've said to people at like industry presentations and to my students. It's like you have this company that services the sanitation industry, presumably with things like urinal lollies and so on, and it's fairly good money that you've got to do the show, isn't it? You don't have to give numbers.
The primary sponsor, and they've been with me, this is the third season, is Sanitrax International, who are actually based in Holland, but they've got a footprint in North America and across Europe.
Yeah.
And the team at Sanitrax reached out to me when I'd done maybe four episodes, and I get an email, "Hi Pete, can we talk? We're really interested in sponsoring your show." Well, Lewis, at that point, I maybe had five listeners and four of them were me. You know, it was crazy. And where do you start? It was a completely untested, nobody knew I was, nobody knew what the show was. But I worked with them and talked through, and we ended up signing a four-figure sponsorship deal in that first season. And then they've renewed that and increased the amount of money that they've put into the show. And it's just gone from strength to strength. And I've been really grateful that I've had their support. They've been brilliant to work with. I've said a few times, it's not just the money. That's helped me buy the equipment and lots of merch and stuff that I give to guests. But the main benefit I got from that relationship was they know everybody.
And also you get, as I know I'm preaching to the choir here, you also get a form of validation in that you've got them behind you, so that makes it easier for you to, you know. As I say, you're a case study for a whole lot of different things to do with, like, independent media projects, you know, like the way that you've kind of done it and it's unfurled for you. You know, without being too prying, like, I'm guessing that it wouldn't be the sort of money that they're renewing it for with. This is actually your full-time job, but it's just helping you keep the show going, right?
Yes. So the show is entirely self-financed through the sponsorship money. I've not had to put any money into it at all. And I've said previously, I would have done the show if I'd had to pay for everything, but it finances itself and there's a bit of profit left over. I had to pay tax on the profit last year.
I saw that you registered for GST. I'm like, who registers a podcast as a company?
Honestly, I've got a limited company.
Yeah.
And the reason there's a limited company is the sponsors wouldn't deal with me just as an individual. They wanted to do things properly.
Yeah.
And they asked me to set up, in the States they call it an LLC. So I set up the company. It's GST registered. And I'm not near that 60,000 threshold for GST, but you don't need to be.
No.
The benefit is all of the business expenditure is covered by the podcast. And as I say, at the end of the last year, the podcast company had to pay some tax because there was just money I couldn't lose.
Yeah.
At the end of the year, I had a surplus.
You probably paid a little bit more than Trump did, you know?
Or Jeff Bezos.
So, because I know you're on this road trip as well, it's like you're sort of, it seems like quite an interesting, kind of quite vital period of your life at the moment. But, you know, out of interest, like, do you have a quote unquote day job at the moment, or is being on the road part of this?
No, right. And people might struggle to get their head around that, but the story is we sold our house. We were planning to downsize, and we couldn't find a property that we wanted to buy, a smaller property, so we thought we'd have an adventure. And it's not completely off the wall because we've done this before. When we moved to New Zealand from the UK, we sold everything, we brought a motorhome with us, and we spent 6 months on the road in New Zealand. And the last year, we've been doing the same. We've bought a new house. It'll be ready in March.
Great.
And we'll decide after that what we do, whether we, you know, keep the caravan and carry on travelling ad hoc or whether we sell that and do something else. But this year's just been a brilliant year. There's me, my wife, my daughter and the dog. We're never going to get that time with our daughter ever again. She's going to leave home as soon as we finish. She'll be off to college.
I was going to say, so she's what, teenage years, late teenage
19,
years?
19, yeah. She's 19 yesterday. She left school. Couldn't go overseas for an OE like her brothers had done.
I feel for people around her age at the moment, like, sorry to cut you off, but my young cousin's about that age, and then, of course, as you know, I teach people around that age. And, look, I know every generation experience, you know, set of circumstances has their advantages and their disadvantages, but it is a pretty, not the greatest time that I remember
it's
to be that
difficult.
Age.
And
you know, she's living with you guys, and, you know.
Oh, yeah. And that's hard. She will tell you she's completely over it. Her generation from Christchurch, you know, they went through the earthquakes when they were primary school before they got to intermediate school. She was at Girls High for the mosque shooting and witnessed the aftermath of that.
Oh, my goodness.
Now we've had COVID. I mean, I think we need to really nurture this generation because they're going to be so vulnerable to trauma and post-traumatic stress through no fault of their own. It's just been the most bizarre period in history, the last 10 years.
I know from a friend my age, like a very good friend, actually, you know, one of the best friends, it just sort of dawned on me last night when I was thinking about it, crossed my mind. And he's been through all, he went through all of that in Christchurch, and he had a young baby at the time during the main Christchurch earthquake. And I've just in the last few years kind of noticed a change in his temperament, and I suddenly thought, I wonder whether, you know, name bleep here has got some PTSD. You know,
it's, I would be surprised if they haven't.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just been an incredible time, and hopefully brighter times are on the horizon. But, you know, I remember back when I was 18, 19, I went off to university, I did my own thing, I went travelling, you know, and this generation just aren't getting the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
As parents, I'm going to be really selfish, Lewis, and say this is just the best of times for me, because I'm never going to get this time with my daughter ever again.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as she will tell you she hates it.
Oh, you know, and then they say you're 20. I hate to tell you, Pete, they say your 20s is about trying to get as far away from your parents as you can. But then it'll be, just wait 10 years, Pete.
You know, Lewis, one of the things I'm most proud of is the fact that the three of us and the dog, and the dog's really grumpy. She's old and crotchety. But the three of us have survived in an 8-metre caravan for almost a year now.
Yeah.
And I could count the number of times where we've had crosswords or disagreement, or people have just rolled their eyes. On one hand, we've just managed to sail through it. Even at lockdown, we were stuck in Fittianga in a car park for 3 weeks because we couldn't move anywhere. Not on power. Every last drop of water I put into the caravan had to come in jerry cans from a standpipe a mile away.
Yeah.
And we've sailed through all of that. It's been a fascinating journey. We've been to parts of New Zealand that we've never, ever been to and probably won't ever come back to.
Yeah.
It's just been brilliant. And the one thing I'll say is there are a lot of people living on the road. My biggest regret is I had this, when we spoke earlier, I had this idea that I'd do this show called the Kiwi Caravan Show, and I just wanted to put the recording desk out.
You also had an idea you'd do a show called the Kiwi Podcast Show.
Nobody else would sign up for that. You were the only volunteer.
I really enjoyed it. I'm on a one-episode podcast. Yeah, anyway.
And we were going to talk to Kiwi podcasters and interview them and even let other people host it.
Yeah.
Not one other person came forward and said, can I be part of the show?
Oh, this is episode 2, Pete. This is unofficially episode 2, mate. Sorry, I cut you off. Do you remember where you were? You said you were going to start. You started off doing the Kiwi Caravan Show.
Yeah.
And then
I was travelling alone, I would have set the recording studio up in the caravan and just invited everyone we met on the road to come in and have a yarn for an hour.
Yeah.
But because it's our home, I can't really do that. It's unfair on the other two to be bringing every Tom, Dick and Harry in for a yarn. But as a concept, honestly, Liz, I've heard some incredible stories. One guy we met, 82 years old, and he said to me, you know, my wife died when I was 67, and after the funeral, I sat looking at the walls at home and thought, right, what are you going to do? Sit here and wait for your turn or have some fun? And he's 82. He's been on the road for over 15 years.
Wow. Could have just sat there and, like, watched TV1 for the rest of his life, right?
Yeah, but, you know, he's done hundreds of thousands of kilometres around New Zealand just meeting new people and seeing a different sunrise every day.
Just lastly on your daughter, again, because I'm interested, because I've just taught that age for so many years, and what's going on at the moment, I've reflected a lot on it. But it's also actually related to the way you guys are touring around. Like, so how does the social side of things work for her if she's 19 and you guys are kind of not of an abode? Like, where are all her mates? Are they in Christchurch?
Yes, pretty much.
I suppose social media makes life easier, right?
Yeah, she's not a social media user. She's got an Instagram and a WhatsApp, but she's not a Facebook person. That's been the biggest worry, that she's been isolated from friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's pretty self-reliant. She'll do her own thing.
Great.
She'll, whenever we park up anywhere, she'll disappear and go off walking and exploring on her own.
Great.
She keeps herself really occupied in the caravan. And she, a few times she said, oh, what am I going to tell people? I've just been on hold for a year. And my reply has always been, tell people you've been on a tiki tour exploring New Zealand. You don't have to justify anything.
Yeah, you'll have more. God, imagine, everyone else who's been in lockdown, she'll have more stories than I do from the last year. God, I can describe to you each one of my light bulbs. That's what I can do. You know?
There's such pressure on young people these days to make decisions really early on. And if I reflect back, when I was 16, I chose English, history and economics as my A-levels, which meant that I've never had a career in science or engineering because I didn't do maths or science.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at the time. I just chose three subjects I quite enjoyed. My first degree I did in English literature, language and creative writing degree.
Yeah.
Why did I chose that? I don't know. I don't regret it, but in hindsight, would I do it again? Probably not. And the gift we've given her, my daughter at this time, is just to take some time out, think about her options and decide what she wants to do and when.
Yeah, and I think it's great that she's not on social media now that you say that she isn't, because that whole thing of like what have you been up to for a year, I think there's a big pressure on that generation to be really visual and show every single moment of their amazing life playing out in real time. So with the podcast, you came to this and I listened to you talking about things like, it was really interesting listening to that presentation or whatever you want to call it that you did for the podcasting group, because you talked about process leading up and, you know, finding gear. And I did a whole lot of that beforehand as well. Like, I was like, if I'm going to launch my podcast, like, I know what I like. I know what sounds good. Basically, I don't just want to jump into it straight away. I want to, like, do a little bit of legwork first, you know, audio quality, website, da 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 da. But I did have a broadcasting background, and that helped, I think. Yeah, have you done anything like this before you launched the show?
No, I've spent a long time lecturing at Polytech and university.
Oh,
so
did
maybe
you?
20 years of adult education.
My God, how old are you, Pete? Can I ask how old you are?
53.
Wow, you have packed a lot in.
Yeah. So my specialist subjects were really management, frontline management, first line management, and then strategy. And then I've also been involved along the way in a number of events. So back in my first job, I organised the regular five-a-side competition, and I've put on some cycling road races, and I've got a good friend, and we've done a few small-scale events. And that led me into teaching on event management, just because you know how it works in New Zealand. Does anybody know about event management? Oh, I've done a couple of events. Right, you're now the lecturer in event management.
I put on my friend's 21st. Yeah.
So my background was in talking, and everyone who knows me will tell you that Pete's a talker. He likes to talk.
You don't say.
The podcast came about. I've been a really big podcast listener for a long time. One of my friends, Nick, got me into podcasts back in the day when they were really in their infancy and there weren't many shows that you could find online.
How far back? Like when oh God, it's going to slip my mind. Ricky Gervais's show blew up, like that far back?
Oh, or? Yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
right.
Wow. Like, I remember searching on Apple Podcasts. It'd probably be the early 2010-12, something like that.
Yeah.
So, I'm an avid listener, and I'll blame the earthquakes on this. Post-Christchurch earthquakes, I've really struggled to sleep. Even 10 years after the event, I'll wake up regularly during the night. It's become a habit now. And one of the strategies I use to cope with that is just to put my headphones in and listen to talking while I go to sleep, and that helps me sleep really well. And I'm at the point now where I've actually run out of interesting stuff to listen to in all the mainstream. So I've been listening to all the really random shows that you just wouldn't find normally.
Do you know there's a podcast of a guy that actually purposely, his aim is to put you to sleep because he's so dull? And the way, Google that. There is a podcast that he guarantees he will send you to sleep. So
I've been working my way through your list of 400, and I listen to all sorts of random stuff, and I don't have a particularly favourite genre.
Oh, speaking of that, but, Pete, like that's a, sorry to cut you off again. That's a
don't apologise.
That's sort of like it's a love hate thing. That it's like I thought it was going to be a bit of a game of whack a mole, but I went to go and have another go at it last night. You know, to start, I put them on a list before I actually put them up with the image and everything, and I added another 80 or 90 New Zealand shows last night.
It's great. It's a really blossoming industry,
and
most of it, I think most of the really good content is just done by people at home. It's not from the big media companies, it's from the independents. They've got some really interesting and unique perspectives.
Although I will say that what the big media companies are doing really well, and I mean there'll be way more examples than I give, but certainly like The Australian, the newspaper in Australia, RNZ Here, Stuff, the list, there's a bunch of, you know, American examples, is really good, really highly produced investigative shows. So like long, you know, 10 episode pieces of journalism with beautiful sound design. But, you know, that's the whole thing where it becomes like defining different, like the categories on Apple aren't actually very useful. Like
not when you're in the sanitation podcast.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. So first things first with sanitation, why is the term, because I grew up with the term, they were called portaloos, and then I think the, don't the North Americans say porta potty or something like that?
Yes, no, they do.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And so is sanitation like a word to like, because it's like everyone shits, but it's sort of like, I imagine it's one of those industries where you've got to kind of zhuzh it up a bit. So where does the term sanitation come from? Is it something to do with that?
The leading international body is called the Portable Sanitation Association.
Yeah.
So they really set the tone. Portaloo in New Zealand is a trademark term, so I don't use that.
Right.
I interviewed a guy a couple of weeks ago who uses at Portaloos as his Instagram handle.
Yeah.
And he said to me he's holding his breath because he knows of a company in the UK who was sued, and it was several thousand dollars the fine that they got for using the term Portaloo.
I don't think that they even existed, that they've existed that long in New Zealand, because I have really young childhood memories of being at a festival and it being a long drop.
Yeah.
Like, they've actually not been around a whole lot of decades, have they?
I know that you can trace the history in New Zealand back to the 80s. A couple of the hire companies started to bring units
there
in from
you
overseas.
Go. Yeah. Because I was at Brown Trout Music Festival as a 4 or 5 year old. It's one of my earliest memories.
Yeah.
It must have, the long drop must have been quite confronting for it to be one of the things I remember about the festival.
And you know, some of those early restrooms that came in during the late 70s, early 80s are still in use. You still, because they last forever.
Yeah.
Unless, because they're made of plastic and fiberglass, unless they degrade with the UV, you'll find cabins around, you might see them in people's paddocks, but some operators are still using toilets that would be 30, 40 years old.
Well, they kind of were essentially plastic above ground long drops for a while. Like, the experience has become a lot more pleasant with how they kind of shut at the bottom and all the rest of it now. I mean,
and that's the reason why I started the show, because I've been to festivals where you open the door in the restroom and you just think, whoa, I'm not going in here, and that's unnecessary. It doesn't have to be like that anymore. So my whole, the primary drive when I started the show was to talk about restrooms for restroom operators and show them that, hey, you know, you can lift your game. And nowadays, there's some of the technology that's available is incredible. I mean, Sanitrax is vacuum flushing. It's LED lights. It's got music. It's got automatic doors. I mean, it's just incredible. It goes on and on and on. And yet, it's a toilet for going to the bathroom.
Maybe. Smart toilet. It's a smart toilet.
Yeah.
So what is that? What causes that? What I'm asking about is the kind of negligence. I guess it's like any other industry, in that some people may cut corners, and by that I'm not, because you're part of this industry, I'm not meaning necessarily just the industry. I'm guessing it might be like tight event producers who don't invest enough.
When you offer toilets to construction and events, the customer who's hiring it is always going to think about price first.
Yeah.
And that's a real shame, because certainly in this country, a lot of restroom operators have dropped their prices in order to secure work. And you can't provide an A1 service when you're being paid very little money per unit on the job. And that's a global phenomenon. I've seen that, and I've heard that reported in Europe and in the States and in Canada and Australia, that people pay as little as possible, and therefore the service has reflected that.
And just quickly, do you think that's particular to sanitation? Like, I'm thinking maybe because people don't perceive it as kind of frontline or as glamorous or as public facing as other things, but, or is it just people just try and squeeze the dollar out of every part of setting something up?
Probably that.
Right. Because I thought the reason I asked that, because I thought
looking for the biggest margin. The difference that we've seen in the last 2 years is COVID, that now everybody is very aware of sanitary conditions. They're very aware of the need for washrooms. And, you know, I have a feeling that people don't want to go to a bathroom and lift the lid and see everything in the tank. So flushing units and vacuum units are becoming more and more popular. Prestige Loos in Auckland have got some of the most modern equipment in New Zealand. But it's not cheap, so the price for that's got to go up. What we're seeing at the minute in the restroom industry globally is huge demand for units. The factories have been on lockdown, or they've been closed down, or they can't get plastic resin to make new units. And operators have deployed what they would class as their event fleet. So the 300 toilets that they kept for your Rhythm and Vines or your Rhythm and Alps, they've been deploying those on the ground. And globally now we're seeing that events are really struggling to get restrooms for the 21-22 season. And when they can get them, the price has gone through the roof. And
so I must have missed a crucial part of that anecdote. So what's causing the shortage? Just COVID generally messing up supply chains?
So there are maybe 7 or 8 companies in the world that produce plastic toilets in big numbers.
Gotcha.
And some of them were shut down. So the Australian ones were closed down. The American ones were closed down through COVID.
Yeah.
Then the supply chain has been incredibly tight. So getting freight to and from the factory has been virtually impossible. And then the other drama that happened in January was the ice storms that hit Texas, like a 1-in-500-year event, closed down the petrochemical factories which make the plastic pellets that they use to make the portable restrooms. And the backlog has been months long. So people have ordered toilets in February, March, and some of them still haven't been delivered.
And so why do they need ordering for New Zealand if you've said they kind of stick around for 30 or 40 years? There is a level of attrition and damage and...
Just growth in demand.
Oh, just growth in demand.
I mean, in Christchurch alone, I think there are 20 restroom operators in a city with 400,000 population.
Oh, wow. That's I was going to ask you that. I just sort of thought it might be one of those industries like where, if I had to guess in Auckland, I might say there's 5 companies supplying them, but... You're saying there's
a lot more than wow. that.
Are they all of similar size, or is there like some guys like eking out an existence with 5 of them and then another lot with like 200 of them?
That's one of the features of the industry. So you've got, globally, you've got some really big players. In the US, you've got United Site Services up for sale at the minute. If you've got a cool $4 billion in your pocket, it's yours. At the other end,
wow.
I know people who've got 10, 15 toilets and they do it as a sideline after hours or at weekends and they make money. For a one-person operation, I think anything from 100 to 300 toilets is enough to earn a good living and not too many that you're overwhelmed. But the market is just saturated with all manner of different sized operations, people with 1 truck, 2 trucks, 5 trucks, up to your big national chains. And really in New Zealand, the biggest operator we've got has got about 5,000 toilets. In the States, you've got individual operators, multiple operators in one city would have 5,000 toilets.
So who's our big company?
Prestige Loser.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's the ones you see. I see a lot of events.
There's another hire company has got a national footprint. They're probably the hire company is probably the only company in New Zealand with a national footprint. There are a lot of regional operators.
So you're talking about, you know, it's like innovation and every industry has that. And this is an industry that I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who hasn't used a portable toilet. So it's not like it's a niche product. Is there a Silicon Valley for sanitation industry? Is there somewhere that has a whole lot of innovation, or like who's innovating for the industry? Like I just can't think who'd be doing R&D for. Is it within the industry
and it's not just in the portable restroom industry. You've got the chemical companies are innovating. So the big move for the chemicals has been to move away from formaldehyde to environmentally friendly products. You've got the obviously the restroom companies bring out new designs.
So wait, where does formaldehyde go?
Originally, the blue chemical that you put in the toilet tank to reduce the smell was formaldehyde.
Ah.
So now it's eco-friendly. And there are other alternatives. I interviewed one guy on the show, David Pipkin, from a company called Porterclear, that's a non-chemical-based solution that completely biodigests the waste products and eliminates the odour.
Sounds like it's fire. Is it fire?
He wouldn't tell me what was in it, but people who've used it have told me it's a game-changing product.
And then also globally, just thinking about even one marked distinction is that a lot of people from Asian countries obviously crouch. Like, so is there regional variations in the units?
Yes, there are.
Yeah.
I interviewed a lady in Paris, from Paris, a couple of weeks ago, Natalie, who's got a product called Madame P, which is a female squat urinal.
Yeah.
So, you know, bloke's urinals have been around for a long time. And
the squat ones are really common in Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the other big differences is that some cultures in the world don't use toilet paper.
Yeah, of course.
And so that that's a really big change, because most portable restrooms in the Western world would be equipped with a toilet paper dispenser.
Yeah.
And then you go to some countries, Indian, subcontinent, and some of the Arab countries, they don't use paper at all. And that presents a whole different challenge.
So this is the thing where we get into this area where, like, you guys in the industry will just go directly into the next area where this naturally goes. So yeah. I would say next to this, so what then do you have? A whole lot of hand sanitizer or...?
Yeah, there's lots of different products. The green standard or the gold star standard would be running water. So
yeah.
And that gets really difficult in a portable restroom because
a big event. Someone that's a lot of carting stuff on and off site. Just the water wise, yeah,
massive. Yeah. I remember working at the coast to coast race in the South Island a few years ago, and we deployed maybe 200 toilets from Kamara on the west coast all the way to Sumner Beach, and getting water to those units was a major mission in itself because there were no taps in the middle of the island. You know, you're in paddocks in the middle of nowhere.
Is there a minimum requirement by law at something like an event or a building site? So one example is, you touched on it before, I remember being at, there was a festival a lot of my listeners will have heard of called The Gathering in the late 90s. It was kind of recognised as when dance culture really had reached a peak here, and they had a year where their attendance just super. There's a whole backstory. There was forged tickets. It got more successful than they realized beforehand. So basically, they didn't have the facilities for the people. And I remember this sign because the humor in it was great. There was a portaloo tied shut with a handwritten sign on it saying "Do not open," literally full of shit. So yeah. From there, I asked, like, if you guys, or you're not actually operating at the moment, but if there's a company that is hired to do an event, like, basically, where does the buck stop and who does the responsibility lie with in terms of if there's not enough service provided?
That's a great question. Let me tell you, the people who know all about restrooms are the restroom operators.
Yeah.
And let me tell you that the people who like to make decisions at those events are the event organisers.
Or the accountant.
Don't know very much about sanitation.
Yeah.
And there's often a conflict. There's a coming together there where people can't agree. Price is usually the determining factor. I'm a pretty straightforward fellow, and if I'd thought that the event organiser hadn't ordered enough toilets, I would have told them.
Yeah.
And I would probably have put extras in without forcing the revenue, just so that our name wasn't dragged through the mud.
So you slipped a few freebies for the look of the good look of the company.
And I think a lot of restroom operators would do that, Lewis, to be honest.
But then I would think a good event manager, and I guess this sums up some, you know, people who are more successful than others would realise that, never mind my extreme example of a toilet literally full of shit, but just people queuing. Like, you know, I've heard people talk about reason A or B or C they didn't like a particular event is there was too much queuing. So that's the other thing,
one thing that will ruin your event's reputation is poor sanitation, without a doubt.
Bar queues and sanitation queues. Yeah, I reckon.
Yeah, queues.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. I had this conversation with Natalie Desinard from Madame P a couple of weeks ago. If ladies are in a queue at an event, A, they're not buying alcohol.
Yeah.
And B, they're not enjoying the event. So they've gone to see a band and they're standing in a queue for the restroom. Once they've been to the restroom, they won't drink anything more because they don't want to queue again.
And meanwhile, us animals are just anywhere, you know. It's like, because it's funny you say that. I didn't realise it till you said it. In my mind's eye, it was a queue of women looking like they could have been having a way better time.
And that's why Natalie's developed the Madame P. So it's really quick and convenient to use. It's just for ladies to go.
It's a female urinal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's incredible. And I know that the boys at Prestige in Auckland are already talking to Natalie to bring some of those units in. The great thing about Prestige as a company is they're really imaginative, and they've got the revenue that they can buy units to market test them. So they've brought Sanitrax, the show sponsors. Prestige brought Sanitrax to New Zealand, and it's $1 million equipment. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
But they brought it to New Zealand. And, you know, first to market always wins, Lewis. Always wins.
So something like Madame P, who sounds like, to be honest, it sounds like there's kink involved, but anyway, are you, and this is, you know, this is your chance to horn toot, like, Is there any, you must be playing a role in some of these people making connections.
And do you know, that's been the best thing about doing the podcast. So I'll give you a current example. Billy Jo Hohepper from B-Day, Auckland-based lady. She used to present on Maori TV. You will have seen Billy Jo.
Yeah.
Very charismatic lady. She's come up with this range of products. There's an automatic toilet seat lifter. And then she's got a foam spray that you spray onto toilet paper, and it turns your toilet paper into a really luxurious wet wipe. And it sounds crazy, but honestly, I've used the product and it's just fantastic. I'm a convert.
Yeah.
Billy Jo came on the show. I interviewed her. We had such a giggle doing the interview. I edited the show and I released it. Within 10 minutes, she's fielding calls from people who'd heard that episode in the States.
That's fantastic.
She's now entered a non-disclosure agreement with a couple of people in the States to help her develop and push her products into that US market. Would that have happened without Get Flushed? Sure, she's a determined lady. She would have got there, but it would probably have taken her another year or so, and it would have taken her a long time to make the connection.
Well, just that ability to be able to explain what it is you've got and what you do, meaning her, goes a long way than trying to email or PM people or sort of like, you know. Yeah,
and she said to me she never does cold calls because she always likes an introduction, and I so identify with that. That if somebody can introduce you to somebody else, and that's what's happened. She's met somebody through the show. He got in touch with me. I put them in touch, and now he's helping her push forward to make a gain in that US market, which she's not sold into yet.
Just back a little, because it's something that's on my wee list here that I still want to ask about. You said you got into the industry. How did you end up in it, and what were you doing? Like, were you operating, or were you actually out on the front line delivering units and doing all of that?
No, I was managing a regional depot.
Right.
So there were maybe 7 or 8 trucks out of that depot, and then we had satellite branches. So I managed that, but I'm a very hands-on manager. So I'd jump in the truck and I'd go and do deliveries. If a driver phoned in sick, I would drop my work and go and do the run to make sure the customers didn't suffer. And I think that mentality is really common in the industry.
Yeah.
It's unusual to find people who are involved in a management level in the restroom industry who don't get hands-on. Really unusual.
And when you're like, I don't really go to dinner parties, but this is like one of those ways you frame a mental image of a social situation. But you're at the dinner party, you're at the bar, you tell someone what you do. Do you get some people who judge you immediately in a negative way? Not as a podcaster, Pete. We're amazing.
I'm pretty.
But as a sanitation, it's a sanitation industry. I'd imagine it go two ways. If you hit me, even if I wasn't doing a podcast, you'd immediately get asked all these questions anyway without me recording.
People are fascinated, Lewis.
Yeah, honestly, but I was going to say, like, I'm interested whether, like, you know, people. I have a distinct kind of disdain for social hierarchy. So I'm interested if anyone snooty has ever kind of gone, and then not looked at you for the rest of the night.
If they have, I haven't noticed.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you're obviously not going to those awful events. So, yeah, people are fascinated. That's what I figured. Like, when I prepared for this podcast, I'm like, well, I think it's a topic where, like, everyone's faced a portaloo. Everyone enjoys going. There's just so many reasons that everything I asked is probably like, who else gets to ask this stuff of...
Do you know, that's been one of the best things about the podcast. I've had some really intimate conversations about bodily functions with guests that I couldn't have in any other forum, I think.
That's the other thing I want to ask there is, like, I'm not immediately going straight to bodily functions, but in terms of operating, like, there must be moments where it's not for the squeamish, and like other people, it's sort of like you just get used to things like smells.
Oh, people become immune to the smell.
Yeah.
I work with one guy, I'll give him a shout out. I work with a guy called Dave who couldn't handle the smell at all. And he would physically retch.
He's completely in the wrong job. Yeah.
You actually become immune to it. You get olfactory. There's a technical term I can't remember. Olfactory fatigue.
Yeah.
So your nose actually stops recognizing that smell.
Yeah. Well, it's also, I mean, like on a kind of more pleasant example of that. It's like when. Let's say the family home you grow up in smells a certain way, you can't smell it. But, you know, other people's houses, everyone's house has a particular smell. Well, it's the same sort of thing.
We've got a dog with us. Our caravan probably smells of dog, but we can't smell that.
Yes. And then, you know, as a part of that, I would hope that kind of like transfer and movement technology and so on has got a lot better, where you're actually like, I don't know how it works. Like, you kind of like, how do you vacate those puppies? Do you,
vacuum tank? So yeah. You have a big tank on a truck with a vacuum pump and you slurp the contents out using what's known as a wand. And I have to say, it's really therapeutic.
Why is that? Go on, keep going.
You get your plastic wand and it's typically a 2 or 3 inch plastic pipe. You lift the lid, you put the pipe in, you open the valve and you suck everything up.
Delicious.
The big kid in me just finds that just hugely entertaining.
Well, I remember being at another festival and, again, like high demand, probably not enough units on site, but to their credit, they were getting the guys in, you know, every so often. But there was it must have been the wind went in a particular direction. And I still remember this. I just love the humor in moments because every time the guy started like, he started to put a little bit of theater into it too, because this is what was happening. Like every time he was pulling, it's like he was disconnecting something, or anyway, anytime he stopped connection, basically the wind would catch a perfect direction where it would waft over a bunch of people and I'd hear everyone like react like they're on a roller coaster, and then it would stop again and it was like the roller coaster would back up and everyone would go again, and this guy was just completely nonplussed because again, it's your job, right? You just get used to it.
You do, and other people will smell it. You know, you try very hard not to splash any. You don't want to be wearing it, and you certainly don't want to be eating it.
Well, that's the last thing. You know what? That's a lesson for life, Pete. That's not just about portaloos. The last question there would be: look, someone's got to eventually clean the units and so on, and people can just be terrible humans, right? We've all seen, and this is another thing, honestly. Like, I'll tell you another story, toilet related, that I've noticed to the credit of just humanity in general. And, you know, you're of a certain age where you'll be the same. Never mind portable toilets, which we've already talked about didn't exist up until the 80s here. Just the state that public toilets used to be in has got a lot better. Used to be quite a harrowing experience going to them. But anyway, back to my original question is, how do you make the cleaning process once you get them back on site as hands-off as possible? I'd imagine just a hose from a distance.
The industry standard is a hot pressure wash.
Yeah, like when I worked in a butchery.
There's been some really cool developments lately. There's some really strong foaming sanitizers, so you cover them in bleachy foam, for want of a better description.
Yeah.
And then you have to get in. You have to get stuck in with a brush normally and give them a really good scrub.
Yeah, that's not
the one area when toilets are on site. That's the one area that restroom operators typically fail on, that they don't clean the units properly on site.
So at a big festival, like, would they have staff from the company on site, like, throughout?
Sometimes,
yeah,
yes. Obviously, that doesn't come free, so a lot depends on whether the organiser is willing to pay for that. I remember doing a big festival in Nelson a couple of years ago at Christmas time, Bay Dreams, and we had a crew of maybe 7 people at the festival.
That would be where people would be terrible at something like that, like young, way too out of it people.
The gates opened at 11 o'clock, yeah. We did the first service at 1 o'clock and they were full already. And then by the time we got to 4 o'clock to do the second service, we had to get the police to part the crowd to give us access to the restrooms. It was insane, because people were desperate to use them, and all of a sudden they see a cleaning crew closing off 20 or 40 toilets. And it was a really, really intimidating situation. I'm laughing, but it was just somewhere I'd never want to go again. It was really scary at the time.
If you remember this, or at least when you listen back to this, you'll be reminded again. There's a YouTube video called something like The Worst Festival Ever, like question mark. It's not saying it is. And it was in the 70s somewhere in the States. But one of the things it opens with is the number of toilets to the number of punters. And I can't remember what it is, but it's something along the lines of like, in this, I think it's like 8 to 40,000 or something. So already before they started, they had their work cut out for them. And then lastly, while we're at the pointy end of it, is there a bit of like gallows humour in the industry in terms of like
hugely.
poo war stories?
I used to take photographs all the time.
Oh no!
And I
who do you show those to?
A calendar
for the industry, and it can sit behind someone on the phone smoking a big cigar.
And I worked with a beautiful lady called Wendy, and our motto was better work stories. We just used to laugh all the time, cry with laughter all the time. The one story that stands out is that we put maybe 200 toilets into Hagley Park for a well-known Christmas concert event. You'll know the one I'm talking
about. Yeah, it's called Christmas in the Park.
So we deploy these toilets and we put them in 2 days before because it's a big job. You move 200 restrooms and it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So we put a bank of 100 in and we turned them all doors in. We locked all of the doors and then we wrapped them in cling film tape all the way, ran round.
Right. So like they're about to be shipped, like they're about to be put on a shipping container.
Yeah. And these things had come from the yard. They'd all been scrubbed clean by Alan, the yard man. Everything was spotless. When we unzipped them and turned them round, there was a great big number two in one of the urinals. Like, the guy must have climbed in through the chimney. Like, how the hell he'd got in. But somehow he'd managed to break the seal, open the door, get into the unit, and then leave us a present. And I found that hugely amusing. Just like, how the hell did he get in?
It's amusing, but then also, like, I overthink these things, and I start to, like, psychologically evaluate people, and I'm like, that is so, like, it's so animalistic. We're just animals. It's like, what is the message this guy was sending out? Like, what was he saying here? Not like, oh, I really needed to go, and I had to, like, hurry, and I ended up doing it in the wrong place. It's like, no, I actually had to formulate a plan to get in and do this. And then,
it must have been a security guard or somebody who was there with access at night, because it would have taken them ages to just untangle the units to be able to get into them.
And what I noticed on your show is, again, because it's such a universal topic of everyone goes poos and wees, basically.
Yeah,
you can go any direction, kind of, like, because there's obviously the industry-based stuff you do. There's the stuff that where people get insight on their industry. They hear other people's stories, new technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the 9/11 episode you did in particular recently made me think, like, you can really take this topic any direction you want. Basically, speak a little bit about that episode so I don't butcher it for you. You basically got someone who put toilets on site at Ground Zero, didn't you?
Dave Andres, who's become a really good friend. I've never met the guy, but Dave phoned me after the very first episode and said, hey, I'm in the industry, and he works for Sanitrek, so he was integral in brokering the sponsorship deal from the start.
Yeah.
And I knew that Dave had been at 9/11, but I didn't know the full extent of his role. I knew that he worked for a restroom provider in New York. And talking to him a couple of weeks ago, I said, you know, it's 20 years since 9/11, and I think back where I was. And he just said, oh, I was at Mr. John. We put 750 restrooms into Ground Zero within the first 2 days. Well, that's just a story that's never been told.
That's the first thing I thought, Pete, is like, of course they need toilets there.
Of course they did. And a number of rescue and recovery workers, and there are still units there because the construction's still going on 20 years after the event. They're still working at that site. And Dave shared his story, and he did it in a very empathetic, deliberate way. There's no glorification of it. I mean, it was a terrible episode for everybody. And if you watched all of the TV shows last week, just a horrible, horrible series of events. But Dave explained his role and the response, and it's just incredible that they were able to provide 750 restrooms in 2 days. It's just the logistics of that alone are something else.
Yeah, and was it? Do you think for him it was maybe kind of cathartic all this time? Like, who else would he have got to tell all of that to?
Oh, Dave's a talker, so he will have shared it privately with friends, I'm sure.
Yeah,
but he's had a number of email and messages on social media. I've had quite a few where people have said, I was there, I was a cop, or I was a firefighter, and I was really grateful for those restrooms being provided. And Dave said to me, it was actually really helpful for me just to share that. It's 20 years of holding that in.
That's what I mean. He would have given people snippets. He might, you know, his partner or whatever might have the full version, but it's not often, and again, preaching to the choir, because you and I have talked about how many of these freaking things we listen to, being podcasts, like, that's part of the appeal, right? People get to really long-form unravel something, like, quite nuanced. And what's interesting, another thing I thought about with that, I don't know if you thought about this, but I was only, just through all those 9/11 docos that got shown recently, there was a couple of really good ones on regular telly, actually, but someone pointed out, you know, not to take anything for a second away from first responders, that what actually happened with 9/11 is weirdly relates to your guest, is a lot of other workers and helpers and people involved kind of fell by the wayside a little bit to the first responder stories. So I see this guy, you know, he is another fireman or policeman or whatever on the day. It's like crisis response, you know, fix a problem.
But no one was telling the story of the restrooms. And Dave didn't mention it, but they had restroom guys who drove in every day to clean those units. And I asked him about that and said the mental toll on those drivers would have been huge, just seeing that level of destruction.
Well, you know about the physical toll, right? And actually, Steve Buscemi has recently, this is quite a deep cut because I think you actually have to buy it off their website, but Steve Buscemi's executive producer on a new doco that's just come out about the health effects still plaguing people who were on site all those days. So not to take too much of a sort of dark tone on in our chat, but yeah, some of those guys that your mate was talking about have probably had long-term health problems from it as well. And so with that, like, you know, what have been other broad human connection moments and sort of specific industry stuff, like what's some of your highlights of realized how hard that would be if someone asked me on my show to remember.
I can answer that really easily.
Okay, good. Right,
November the 16th every year is World Toilet Day.
There you go.
and World Toilet Day was set up by a lovely gentleman called Jack Sim, who's from Singapore.
Yeah.
And I messaged Jack and said, "Hey, Jack, I do this podcast. It's November the 16th, World Toilet Day coming up. I'd love to talk about your World Toilet Organization and just find out the history of that." And within minutes, he emailed me and said, "Ring me at 11 o'clock tonight." And I spoke to Jack and we recorded this episode. And I had a real moment in that I always thought of portable sanitation as a convenience. So we put these plastic toilets onto sites at festivals where there are no restrooms. Or we put them at construction sites where we're building a new house and the plumbing's not in.
Yeah.
And Jack made me realise that there are actually more people in the world who do not have access to sanitation than people who do.
Right.
And the numbers are astounding. The people in the world who don't have a flushing toilet, who don't have a clean water supply for washing or drinking. It's just outrageous that it's 2021 and we've still got people who are living in abject poverty without access to fresh water and a sanitary bathroom.
So even when we're yelling or yelping like we're on a roller coaster when the air comes downwind, or we're queuing a bit long between vinos, we're pretty damn lucky.
Incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
Incredibly lucky. And there's all of the talk at the moment about the three waters and the challenges that New Zealand faces. You know, you see regular contamination of beaches in Wellington. There's just been some up in north of Auckland on the beaches there where the sewer systems failed. And the truth is that our sewer system is generally over 100 years old. We learned that in Christchurch after the earthquake.
Oh, Wellington's got all sorts of problems at the moment with
all
pipes.
Sorts of problems.
I
interviewed Chelsea Wald, who's an American author, a couple of months ago. She's released a book called Pipe Dreams, and she was fascinating to talk to because she's got a real handle on this. Her book is about the future of toilets. And she argued that the plumbed-in, wet-flushing sewered network is not the answer, that we've all gone that way.
In these resource-sparse times.
Hugely expensive, not particularly good for the environment.
Well, also, like you probably have heard, they say the next great war will be over a resource like water, so, yeah.
I've no doubt.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of different technologies that are emerging now. I've been trying really hard for the last 3 months to get a company called Home Biogas to come on the show.
Yeah.
They're from Israel. They've produced a toilet where the waste goes into a bladder and it generates methane. And it generates enough gas per day to run a 4-ring burner for 1 hour.
So we're going to run our ovens with our poo fumes.
Well, so, Jacinda doesn't want us to use LPG, but I'd be putting a home biogas unit in if I had a lifestyle.
Well, that's funny because I was going to tell you that I was going to do a callback and say, "Is the new technology fire?" And then you actually said the new technology kind of is fire.
Well, it is. And I've been trying to find someone who's got one of these units to find out if it works.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to get the developers from the company Home Biogas to come on the show. And for some reason, I don't know whether it's because it's a toilet podcast, but I've just not been able to make that traction. And that's unusual because normally I'm turning people away. Lots of people want to come on the podcast and talk about their innovations, and I'm saying no. And this one company I want to come on, I can't persuade them to step over the
threshold. That's funny. It might even be what I heard you talk about before we jumped online when I listened to that presentation you did, is that sometimes it's just that people don't actually know what a podcast is.
Yeah.
The numbers are quite interesting. It's still fairly niche, although we're at a point where, like, you know, my grandma will know what a podcast is, even though she hasn't listened to one. But anyway, backtracking a little, because you reminded me of something else before I move forward on to my next topic. And I think it's, again, something a bunch of people might know, but I don't, is, like, how do you, once you get back to where the business is located, where is everything emptied to? Like, is there, do you have a direct line to the sewers where you are, or?
So all wastewater in New Zealand that's put back into the sewer network ends up at the wastewater treatment plant, wherever the nearest one is.
So where do you enter? Is there a manhole on site?
Most operators will go to the council wastewater facility.
Gotcha.
Some operators will have a sewer connection in their yard, but even that, there's no standard in New Zealand. Some city and district councils charge a volumetric rate.
Yeah.
Some city.
So it's like going to the tip with a ute versus a van versus a truck.
Some of them multiply that volumetric rate by another factor, which depends on the biological oxygen demand and the total suspended solids in the effluent. Yeah. So that basically, the more lumps, the more oxygen they have to pump in to dissolve all of that. So that some councils multiply the charge by a factor, and it gets quite expensive quite quickly. Other councils have no regulations or control at all. The people just pour it down the sewer.
Are you familiar with Wellington? Like, have you travelled there a bit over the years?
Yeah.
Okay, so when I grew up in Lyell Bay, obviously just by the airport there, and then being in the racket you're in, you probably know that around the corner from there is Moa Point. So when I grew up, I'd have to look up the exact dates, but it was a significant first chunk of my life. There was no treatment at Moa Point. Everything just came out there.
And then into the sea.
And used to, I'm not making this up, like, the best surf at Lyell Bay was when there was the right southerly, but that would also bring in stuff from Moa Point. And so if you're going to get a good wave, you're also going to see white seaweed, and you also didn't want to have any kind of open sores. So I just find that amazing, because it sounds like Victorian-era London. And so my big thing going back there is, like, I don't know how I'm going down this path, but I was just thinking about hope and environment and all this stuff we're thinking about these days. Like, so I actually had to second take when I heard that you can gather seafood from around there. So, like, it doesn't take long to kind of reverse things.
But bivalves are feeders on all sorts of waste.
Well, no, I'm saying that you couldn't when I was a kid at all. But you, like, you the can. It's been cleaned up a lot. Yeah. So to close off with chatting a bit about podcasting and some of the things you said to me you wanted to chat about. You said that you have a bit of an area you're still trying to get your head around, which is listener feedback. What did you mean there? Because it sounds like you're getting more feedback than I am in general. So,
well, I do get listener feedback. Yeah. I've got some loyal listeners who are patrons as well, who will let me know within minutes of me releasing a pre-release episode that there's an audio issue.
Yeah.
Or they'll give me ideas and information about topics that I might want to talk about. I've got very few reviews on the podcast platforms, maybe 10 at most that I can find. And I'm just interested to figure out what you've done, or what you know other podcasters have done to attract reviews, or do reviews make any difference?
From what I'm just riffing this on the spot, because this is what's great about these chats. Like, when you heard an inch wide, a mile deep, I've just had a wee revelation in that I've had a look at a few other podcasts I consider similar to mine in New Zealand, and one thing I'm really happy with mine is the number of star ratings on iTunes, but also quite amazing comments. Like, the little amount of feedback I get, they kind of keep me going. But the little penny drop I just had now is, I think that's because a number of people who left feedback are people I know or know of, and broadly speaking, they're people from media or arts or music. So I think they understand that that's an important part of the process. Like, they're not paying for the content. So do you get what I mean there? Like, so they kind of know that in this day and age, the sort of people who brought up having to hire a video or a DVD or whatever, but also because then they went on to work in that area, I think they realize that that's the koha, is like actually leaving me some public feedback. So what I'm getting at there, just to close off, is I think with your listeners, I think with your listeners, it's not them going, oh, that bloody Pete show, it's rubbish, I just won't say anything about it. It's more like you need to figure out how to, like, I think the thing I used to say is like something along the lines of, I'm going to butcher this, but something along the lines of commenting and rating is the new version of like paying $10 to listen to something or watch something or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I get a lot of direct feedback from listeners who've asked questions or are keen to find out more, or can you introduce me to?
Yeah.
So I enjoy really good communication with the industry listeners. I used to put a segment in every episode where I'd say, you know, if you'd like to support the show, then leave me a review on your favourite podcast platform. And I stopped doing that. Maybe I'll have to resurrect doing it.
Yeah, or just as I say, frame it a little differently and just say that. Because, like, also, as you've talked about, a number of your listeners aren't, like, I'm not saying all of them by any means, but aren't tech savvy, because you were talking about how you're trying to connect some of them with even just listening. So, again, it's probably just that it's education campaign without kind of getting preachy or desperate sounding. Yeah. Just telling them why you do it.
It's good. When I've had comments, they've been really good. I mean, the best one I've had is a guy emailed me and he said, I really love your show because you talk quickly, you don't waffle, and there's no bloody adverts. That it was just fast and furious.
I'll tell you another one. Because they really feel me, because, like, I agree with you. You don't get a lot of feedback with this. It's not like when I did Breakfast Radio 20 years ago, and even that's changed from what I hear, because you get SMSs and stuff now. But the phone would ring, and a listener being on air, it was like very two-way media, and you know, that just, it doesn't happen now. So when you get those bits of feedback, they really fuel me. So how's this? I didn't realize that iTunes feedback is geo-based. So because my account is from New Zealand, I was only seeing the New Zealand feedback. And it turned out I'd had feedback from expats overseas, and my actual written feedback went from, I don't know, like 9 nice bits of feedback to kind of double that when I clicked on the button. And you can find sites that will show you your global feedback as well.
So was that just in Podcast Connect or something?
No, you've got to go through like a third-party thing. Like, you'll just Google, see all my iTunes feedback. Again, it's an old sort of, I don't understand why they still do geo-blocking in this day and age, especially not with free content like podcasts.
No, do you know, and it's funny, because I look at the map for my listeners. So I run Google Analytics and I look at the map as to where listeners are, and I've got some people log in from some really remote locations. Like, I've got Azerbaijani listeners.
I wonder whether there's bots or something, because I get listeners in Russia. There's not people listening to my podcast in Russia. It's so,
well,
it's
maybe
so New Zealand, but well, maybe there are. Maybe the Kremlin are.
I went through a phase, I used Anchor, and their stats that they provide on their free hosting service were brilliant, because it goes down to city, borough and suburb level.
Well,
so you could see who was listening from where, and Podbean doesn't give me that. It just gives me US state.
I use a third, because on my site's through Squarespace, but I use a third-party thing where I put the URL in and it catches it through my... We're going to start losing this. This is less interesting than Portaloos to most people, because not everyone deals with RSS feeds.
They were getting really
techy. But I was going to say that... now I've forgotten what I was going to say about it. Oh, yeah, I use, out of interest, a service called Podtrac, and it's never spammed me heaps or whatever, and it just gives me, like, breakdowns of how many, you know, clicks or downloads each episode's had. But none of it's a hard science, as you know, Pete, because we don't know whether some people auto-download it and haven't listened to it, or they listened to part.
No, that's the thing.
But your thing's measured, by, I think, very much more than mine intuitively, by the fact it's industry-based. So with that, have you had feedback, or people who are listening who are just interested, even though they're not in the industry.
Non-industry listeners.
They've just come across you.
There were two moments that really helped me with that. The first was that I managed to get the show reviewed by Amanda Litherland on the BBC Radio 4 Podcast Hour.
Oh, you are
good.
And
she did a 2 or 3 minute segment, and it was brilliant, honestly. I smiled for weeks when she did that. And in fact, I had an email from a listener last week who said, hey, Pete, I'm camping in Wales, and I've just had the radio on in the car, and they've just reviewed your podcast. That was a year after Amanda reviewed it. So that really helped. And then a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, Fiona Sturgis from the Guardian newspaper reviewed the show. She did a feature on niche podcasts.
Yeah.
And I took the line that where there were key people like Fiona that I wanted to let know I'd produced a podcast, I just kept liking and commenting everything she posted, and then dropped her the odd DM, She was asking for content, and she just wrote back and said, oh, it's not really the sort of stuff I talked about. And then one day she messaged me and said, hey, Pete, I'm going to review your show. It's going to be a bit tongue-in-cheek. Are you okay with that? And my reply was, Fiona, I'd be upset if you didn't take the piss, to be honest.
Oh, that's, you know, I saw, and also saw, like, over the last few weeks, you're a grafter at getting that promo out, because I noticed on, like, CNN sites and stuff, you were putting, like, listen to the what happened with the toilet suppliers and,
the
you know, great, good on you, good
honestly,
on you.
Honestly, yeah. I'm surprised. Well, I did. I got a Facebook warning saying your account has been suspended for 24 hours.
For what?
I spammed. Because I posted that one story you won't have heard about 9/11 is the story of the sanitation response for toilets.
I wouldn't see that as spam. Or did they think right.
Honestly, I put it on like CNN, ABC, Network News, Fox News. I just spent all day, every article I could find, I just posted a link unashamedly to that episode. And it's paid off because that's now become the most successful episode I've released. In the first week, it's had more downloads than
any I'll go listen to it, because I've only listened to one so far, and I actually found it fascinating, because you guys were talking, it was an Auckland-based company, and you guys were talking about just the impact of coronavirus. And one line that I remember from it that I've told people about when I'm talking about smaller podcasts and stuff, and I talk about your show, is just talking about how hand sanitizer became this quite, like, not black market product, but I think you guys were talking
about
how it's started, like, becoming a thing where it was affecting people's bottom line, because a huge kind of goon wine bag of sanitizer would disappear out of the unit. I'm like, well, that kind of makes sense.
Do you know, back in the day, the biggest worry about sanitizer, I probably shouldn't say this, but it's flammable.
Right.
So you didn't want to leave too much, because if anyone decided to, then it would melt the entire toilet.
Or just even when way more people smoked, like someone in there wasted and smoking a cigarette and ba-boof.
Yeah, crazy. So sanitizer's been a massive, more so than toilet paper, I think.
Yeah.
And I interviewed a toilet paper company at the height of the COVID drama, and they said the issue is not producing it. We're still making the paper. It's the distribution.
Yeah, logistics.
We can't get
out
of the door fast enough.
There was something I was listening to the other day where they were talking about the amount of shipping vessels just kind of moored different places
waiting to come into port.
Yeah, around the world at the moment. I got in the Sunday Star Times for my show, which was lovely, and I shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth. The problem I had, Pete, because I heard you say that your Guardian appearance made your numbers go up, is, and admittedly New Zealand's a much smaller readership, but the sub-editor that day just gave it a completely unintuitive headline. Like, it was like some line from a different podcast, and it didn't even say it was anything about podcasts. I didn't notice.
This conversation with Rhys Riley from Kiwi Talks podcast all the time. I talk to Rhys quite a lot. And we are incredibly frustrated that the New Zealand media don't appear to be particularly interested in good news stories about independent podcasts. So, you know, I can't imagine that there are many New Zealand podcasts are making the amount of inroads that some of the shows that we've got.
I've got a short answer to that. I think that they are a duopoly, and I think that they're looking at expanding podcasting, you know, extensively themselves and doing a lot of stuff in-house. And at the same time, I think they're crazy not to connect with external shows, because what's been happening overseas is a lot of organizations like that are actually using, or not using, they're adopting those shows as either concepts or fully fledged shows. So in other words, stuff that people have started for love is turning into like spec content that gets appropriated by those bigger companies. But yeah, I see it. I mean, I don't know whether I'm right here. It's pure speculation, but I think it's that old school, like, you know, the record companies and Napster, you know, that kind of analogy.
Yeah.
I think it's that kind of headspace. Like, no,
And it's funny, like the toilets angle. I don't know if you saw Seven Sharp a couple of days ago. There's a couple down in Oamaru, Awamoa Lose, and they've moved across from Aussie, bought a restroom company, and they managed to get their company featured on Seven Sharp. And it's a great story, and brilliant for them. They're only a small company, a couple of trucks, and, you know, very small footprint in Oamaru. But I can't imagine that a show like Seven Sharp would ever feature a podcast, whether it was about toilets or not. It's just content that, for some reason, they're not interested in.
Yeah, it's a funny one. That was lovely to get that write-up in the newspaper. But, yeah, I think that is something to do with it, that whole in-house, not acknowledging there's other stuff to consume media content-wise. Quite a much smaller market here. Like, you know, I don't know. There's a lot to it.
It was interesting. Just on that, I don't know if you've seen the New Zealand Podcast Awards nominations have been coming in thick and fast over couple of 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I had an email this morning saying somebody had nominated the show. I knew they had because someone told me they'd nominated me. But I've been going through all of the entries that they've been posting on Instagram and just finding out, you know, just to listen, find new content to listen to. And I'm quite shocked that some of the entries have only got 3 or 4 episodes, but they've been nominated.
Well, I also noticed, like, when you talked about wanting to have a quick chat about this, like, I don't know too much about it. It just kind of popped up out of nowhere, those awards. But what
I don't know anything about
it. And also, I don't want to shoot myself in the foot by kind of trying to, like, dissect it right now. But one thing I noticed quickly looking through, because you reminded me, I just went and had a look, in my case, on Twitter, because they're posting them all there as well, is what they don't seem to have also created some sort of delineation between is, like, again, stuff kind of like made by radio jocks that kind of is almost radio show content versus independent stuff. It all seems like it's in one big smushy pit together. They've got more like iTunes kind of categories, like is it this, is it that. But anyway, look, it's their first year. And
no, good on them. I'm really excited that there is an award.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not absolutely not expecting that anyone I know will win because things like that just tend not to happen in my world. But it would be fantastic if somebody like yourself or Reese won for an independent
show.
You're
saying that like I'm on some different level with my podcast. It's just a different space. Like,
I was listening last night. I listened to your Scott episode and your Chris episode.
Yeah,
and I'll blow some smoke your way, Lewis. You've got a very natural way with guests.
Oh, thank you.
And it's always good conversation.
Yeah.
And it's always really interesting. They bring up stuff that while I'm listening, I thought, oh, yeah, that's really cool.
Well, let you in on a little thing. I think the host that I most relate to and that I've probably been inspired the most by is that Mark Maron guy in the States. So I don't know if you've heard his shows WTF, but what I found, you should go and listen to some now. He's talked to Obama. Look, hey, do yourself a favor. Maybe listen to one more regular one, like someone slightly less famous, but you've got to listen to the Mark Maron Barack Obama episode because they leave that one, it never goes behind a paywall.
I was just going to say
the one thing I noticed with him is I think Americans are a lot more used to kind of therapy and kind of letting it lay all out there. So even though I kind of have learned a lot from his style, what I have found is I thought I was going to get a lot more kind of like existentially gritty and deep with my guests. So you're right, I do get a lot out of them, but it's interesting what you learn kind of with regional variations and so on. In other words, like Kiwis kind of don't want to go there like Americans will tend to, you know. It's interesting. Yeah. It's fascinating. What were you going to say?
It's incredible. People like Barack Obama and Bruce Springsteen have got their own podcast now. Everybody wants to be a podcaster these days. It's just incredible.
Well, that's another thing. It's still about a good idea, like the portable sanitation industry having a podcast, though, because what I see happening there, and again, there'll be great ones, there'll be not so great ones, is capitalism always ends up appropriating everything. So that's kind of what's starting to happen with podcasting. So it's like, let's throw big name A with podcast format B and throw it against the wall and see what happens, you know. So it's an interesting
thing. And the biggest lame duck in the pond there would be the Prince Harry and Meghan Markle podcast. They've been paid however many billions of dollars.
That's right.
And they've done one episode and they hardly said anything.
I wish maybe leave it there.